I just really want to reflect on a few things. This is an interesting 4th of July in the history of our country. We're celebrating independence. And we're looking at where we're going, I hope. I want to read some lines. You can read these yourself. They're in the Magnificat for today. They're from Bishop James Conley. When I read the Declaration on the Constitution, I'm quoting from him, I can't read the whole thing, that grew out of it, I see everywhere the spirit of biblical and Christian humanism running through these texts, and that's a fact. Our founding fathers were devout Protestants, but they were very Christian. Now, as he points out, they were humanists, but they were motivated by a Christian vision of man. All men are endowed by their Creator. Who says Creator except biblical people? Nobody else either thinks about it or acknowledges that there's a Creator. We came out of the mud somehow, you know. So, the founders were men of reason, and in the America they founded was not intended to be a theocracy. In fact, just the opposite. The founders specifically disallowed any state-sanctioned religion. Nevertheless, the government they did establish was founded on theistic, if not explicitly Christian, principles. Whatever its precise Christian pedigree, it cannot be denied that our government is based on a belief that human rights come from God, not governments, and that the world is in the hands of what the Declaration of, called nature's God and the supreme judge of the world. In other words, prayer today for the nation is in keeping with the mind of the founding fathers. Now, there's been a threat to that, and I want to talk about that for a moment. This may sound more like a philosophy class than a homily, but I think it's important. Henri de Lubac wrote a very fine book called The Drama of Atheist Humanism, which is what's dominating our country now. It's a humanism, but it's atheist, which means it'll go nowhere. Now, Dostoevsky was a mystic and a prophet. And he wrote this book called The Brothers Karamazov. And in that book, there's a section where Alyosha, one of the three brothers, Karamazov, you know, he's a monk. And he goes to visit his brother Ivan, who's in jail, accused of killing his father. And he goes to visit him. And Ivan starts to tell him, I'm about to write a poem. And I'm going to call it The Grand Inquisitor. And he gives out the plot. And I'm going to read parts of that, you see. It starts off, Jesus is in Seville, the 16th century. He's come back. Now, he's coming out of the cathedral, and they're burying a little girl who just died. And the people who recognize him say, oh, Jesus, please heal this girl. And he raises her to life. Now, the Grand Inquisitor is standing across the street, and he sees that. And he says, arrest that man. So they put him in jail. And about midnight, the Grand Inquisitor goes down there. You'll have to read it yourself. I'm quoting from something I wrote, the meditation on the first Sunday of Lent in cycle C, which is about the temptations of Jesus. And it's this that I want to point out to you, you see. Later in the night, all alone, the Grand Inquisitor visits Jesus in his cell and begins to question him. Jesus remains silent. In this whole thing, Jesus says not a word. In effect, the Inquisitor says, why are you here? Why have you come back? You came and offered men freedom, and that was your mistake. Humans do not want to be free, they want to be safe. Now this is a prophetic understanding of the whole drive of Marxism and all the things that flow from it. And all the great dictators who took over to change the world, Mao Zedong, Hitler, Stalin, and that's why they could murder Hitler, mostly Jews, Stalin, about 10 million, Stalin, 20 million, Mao Zedong, 100 million. And he said, men like me only arrive once every several hundred years, and they can't be judged by the norms of regular humanity. Mao Zedong said that. The Inquisitor brings Jesus back to the temptations in the desert. It has taken us nearly 1,500 years to undo your mistake. This is what's going on. The terrible and wise spirit, the spirit of self-destruction and non-existence. Notice what he calls him? The spirit of self-destruction and non-existence. That's the direction we're heading. The great spirit talked with you, and we are told in the books that he apparently tempted you. You could have changed those stones into bread, and men would have followed you and hung on your every word, but you preferred to leave them free. We, on the other hand, know what they need. We have deceived them, and they willingly let themselves be deceived for the sake of the bread we give them. They will marvel at us and will regard us as gods because, having become their masters, we consented to endure freedom and rule over them. They know there's freedom. Our rulers. The first temptation, now in the desert, the great tempter, you had your chance. See, the great tempter dealt with miracle, the second with mystery, and so the first one, you could have multiplied bread out of stones. Talk about social action. Talk about, you could have done all of this and you turned it down. Because you thought men wanted to be free. They don't want to be free. They want to be safe. They want us to tell them what's right, tell them what to do, and then they feel safe. The first temptation dealt with miracle, the bread. The second with mystery. You could have thrown yourself off the parapet of the temple and forced the angels to catch you. Oh, you understood perfectly that in taking one step and making a move to cast yourself down, you would have at once tempted God and lost all your faith in him, and you would have been dashed to pieces. And the wise spirit that tempted you would have rejoiced. They challenged you, but you still preferred a love that was free to obedience coerced. This once again was your mistake. Men willingly take the burden of their freedom for the comfort of being told what to do. Do you understand? You see, this is demonic, but this is where the world is going. We have corrected your great work and based it on miracle, mystery, and authority. That's why he said, I'll give you all these worlds, all these governments, all this power is run by me, Satan says. I can give it to you if you'll just adore me. And so this is Dostoevsky the mystic, you see, putting these. He sees communism is just beginning in Russia, and he sees where it's going, and he puts it together here, you see. By accepting the last counsel of the mighty spirit, you would have accomplished all that man seeks on earth. That is to say, whom to worship, the source of miracle, to whom to entrust his conscience, the possessor of mystery, and how at last to unite all in a common, harmonious, and incontestable anthill for the need of universal unity in the third and last torment of men. That's the temptation. You could have done all those, and the world would have been yours. And of course, Jesus saw all that. But those are the temptations of the world in which we live. And so, you see, I just felt it was time to look at it. Where are we now? You see, we are in that world. What are people promising us? You see, comfort, food, new cars, whatever we want, you know? And then, food, whatever we need. And you just surrender your freedom and we'll take care of you. There'll be, social security from the time you're born to the time you die. You just conform to us. And they cut the top off life. There's no heaven. There's nothing. But we'll take away the fear. And if you want special injections when you're dying to take away the fear, we can handle that too. That's the great temptation. And we are faced with it. That's why I felt on this feast, when we're celebrating independence, we ought to look and see at the source of our independence. Our independence comes from God. God gave us a free will. And that's where it comes from. And so, you see why we have to take those three things. Social action, of course. But you see, care for the poor. That may be one of our, in the renewal, one of our greatest weaknesses. But do you understand why the Pope is always talking about care for the poor? It's an essential dimension of Christianity. And if we don't do it, they will. And that's important, you see. Yes, we need miracles, but that point to God. And of course, we have to worship the one true God, not the television, not the department store, not the government, God. Now this may put us on a collision course depending on how everything else goes. But if we're celebrating independence, the only real independence is surrender to Jesus Christ. And then we have to show that reality. And I would say most of the charismatic, the covenant communities are middle class. They have to be. To just, you have to have a job, you have to have... But what are we doing about multiplying bread? See, what are we doing about rightful authority? And ultimately, what are we doing to teach people to worship God? It's our challenge. And so I was praying this morning, trying to think of a homily, and all of this came back to me. The insight of Dostoevsky in that section of his book, The Brothers Karamazov, where he saw the rise of... communism, beginning. Lenin had not come into power yet or into prominence, but he could see it moving. And as a prophet, he put his finger on it. And so, that's where we're at. And so, you see, if you're not for feeding the poor, if you're not for... You see, you're a terrible person. Well, you are. But is that feeding the poor meant to be, I take God's place? In feeding the poor, do I make people dependent on me? Or do I set them free to worship God, to love God, and to bring up their children in a way that those children come to know God? You see? This is, I am sure, the crisis we face in this country. All sorts of things that the government will take care of us from the moment of birth till the moment of death. The government will take care of us. And we have no need for God. That's the temptation. And Dostoevsky saw it coming. He saw communism before it really happened in Russia. And he saw where it came from. And he saw who the tempter is. Now we have to look at our own conscience, you see. Are we there? Do we understand that the only one who can really care for us is God the Father? And then do we show the care of God the Father to the poor? I think as a community, this is something we have to look at. You notice how the Pope is talking about Jesus and following Jesus, but he always remembers to talk about caring for the poor. Because he's a prophet. And he knows that this is important. And so that's why he's always talking about it. And if we don't, they will. So on that, you know, it really is a happy note, don't you see? It's truth. We're called to a conversion. Isn't that wonderful? You know, it means looking at our lives, looking at our comfort, looking at whether we're caring for the poor or not. And how do we do it? We all go down and live in the inner city? No, how do we do it? And I think we should pray and ask the Lord. I don't know why this has been ringing in my mind all morning, so a great friend of mine who's dead now, Gino Baroni, he was a priest here, and one of the great social action men, one of my closest friends too. And I remember he came to a prayer meeting. We fought. I told him he had to pray. He said he was busy. I said, you got to keep praying. He never called me again. But then he got cancer. So he came to a prayer meeting. I can't tell you how excited I was. You don't know how much you love somebody till you see them again, you know? So he said to me, yeah, you know, I got cancer. I said, yeah, I heard. He said, I got to learn how to pray. I said, great, Gino. I'll teach you. So I used to go, I said, now just say what I say. I was trying to get him started, you know? Oh, God, I love you. And he, oh, God, I love you, you know? He was doing his best. But he got very sick, was in the hospital, Providence Hospital. I was living with your parents at the time. And I used to take your dad's car and drive, didn't have a car in those days. And I drove down to the hospital and visited and prayed with him. And he was all alone, and we did well. And I would go, and I went often. And one time I was teaching summer school at CU, and the class was over. It was about 2 or 3 in the afternoon. And I just said, I have to go see Gino. You know, by that time, you see, the family had closed in, and if you don't understand what happens in an Italian family when somebody's dying, everybody in the clan shows up. So I could hardly get to see him, see? Anyway, I felt the Lord was telling me to go, so I went. There was nobody there, just Gino. And of course, he had tubes, you know, everywhere. And so I'm praying alone. I'm saying, Lord Jesus, brother. I said, what am I doing that for? So I said out loud, real loud, Gino, it's Francis. The Lord is here. And he's forgiven you all of your sins. This great big smile on his face. And he raised his hands and he really prayed. I was so happy. And I left. And an hour later he died. And, but you see, and he was the greatest. He always had a name, being Italian anyway, you know, in his first generation. So he had an instinct of how to do this that wasn't just big organization and, you know, change the stones into bread kind of stuff. It was dignity. He said, the greatest problem is, and I got to stop because I went too long already, the greatest problem is that the Polish and the Italian and the Irish immigrants are afraid of the blacks. And we have to break that down before there'll be justice in this country. That was his correct insight. And guys would tell me down here, look, I got a doctorate in this stuff. But I won't move a muscle until I get Gino's approval of what I want to do. Because he just knew. So he died beautifully. So there's hope for us all.